As president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Gordon B. Hinckley, who died this past Sunday, presided over the fastest-growing religion in the Western Hemisphere. Joining me now to discuss the history and beliefs of Mormons, as well as the Church's growth, is Lori Maffley-Kipp, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina. She's the co-editor of an upcoming book called Proclamation to the People, 19th Century Mormonism and the Pacific Basin Frontier. It is my pleasure to welcome her to this week's Please Explain. Hello.
Thank you. Hello.
Even though he died at the age of 97, Gordon B. Hinckley had only been president for 12 years. Was it unusual for someone to be elected to that position at the age of 85?
Actually, it's more the norm than something unusual, because the succession to the presidency is based on seniority in the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, and because people aren't elected to the Quorum of the 12 Apostles until they're quite far along in their careers anyway, it means that typically the person selected to be president is up there in years and seniority.
And was he considered to be a prophet of God automatically after he was selected to be president of the church?
Yes. Yes, because the whole process is considered to be God's plan and part of God's will, so that God then bestows upon him the power of prophecy or to receive revelation on behalf of the church.
So this isn't all that different from what happens in the Catholic Church with the Pope.
In some ways, it's not. It's not. It's a very orderly process. It's not... there's no surprise about it, in the sense that, you know, for the Catholics, I suppose archbishops can go into a room and come out with a surprise vote. That doesn't happen in this case. It's already clear who is next in line.
So we know who it is. Who is it?
Thomas Monson.
Mm-hmm. Just because he's the oldest?
No, it's not. It's not his age. It's not that kind of seniority. It's how long he has been in the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. So he has the longest seniority. I think he's been there since the early 60s, if I recall. I can't remember the exact date, but he's had a very long history in the church, but it dates from the time someone is called to be part of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles.
Well, below the Quorum, what does the power structure within the church look like?
Well, it's a very elaborate structure. There are a number of sort of ranks below that. There are groups called the 70s, and those are church leaders who work for, they're paid by the church, but they work throughout the world doing, sort of administering the work of the church throughout the world. Below that, and then you would get down to the stake and the ward level, which are local and unpaid positions. So there's a big shift between full-time administrators in the church and the unpaid called volunteers within local stakes and wards. Stakes are sort of the equivalent of a diocese in the Catholic Church, whereas a ward is the equivalent of a single congregation.
But there are no clergy, per se. There are no priests.
There are no paid clergy. There is a bishop who is called to be bishop of a ward, but there is no payment for that, and it's something that, you know, you're called to it out of the congregation.
Does someone lead church services?
The bishop typically mm-hmm. would lead church services.
Until 1978, black males couldn't become full members of the church. Were the Mormons hurt by the image that situation created?
I think hurt. I mean, they certainly did not gain converts in places like Africa up until after the ban was lifted. Now they're growing quite quickly in Africa. But
was that the reason the ban was lifted, do you think, that they wanted to get more church members in Africa?
Well, it depends on who you ask. I mean, on the one hand, the ban was lifted because the First Presidency decided that, you know, that they, by God's guidance, they decided it was time. God decided it was time to lift the ban. On the other hand, it was a time, and there are lots of scholars who have looked into the fact that it was a time when the church was expanding worldwide, and the issue of who could be ordained was becoming important. Not so much in Africa at that point, but in places like Brazil, where there is a lot of African diasporic influence. It was getting very hard to figure out who was African and who wasn't. And so it created problems for who could be called to the priesthood in a place like Brazil.
Well, given the church's policy regarding black members, should we be surprised that it's been so successful in expanding in Brazil and Africa and other places where people of African descent live?
Yes and no. There are, I think, quite a few people in the church today who are coming into the church today who don't necessarily know that history.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they do know that history, you know, this is something I tell my students when I teach about the Mormons. The Mormons were late in coming to integration in their church, but they certainly weren't the only American church to be segregated. And in fact, you know, up until the mid-60s, most churches were segregated, and most white churches didn't ordain, you know, black ministers. So that's not to excuse sort of the Mormon church, but just to say they came to this a little later. But I think from the outside, from the perspective of a Brazilian or an African, it doesn't necessarily look all that different from other churches in the United States.
Well, might it be even seen as more surprising that a religion whose beliefs are so rooted in America now has a majority that live abroad?
That's what I find really fascinating, is how the church has managed to internationalize its message when, you're right, the history of the church and so much of the traditions of the church are caught up in its history as moving westward across the continent.
And even the future, when Jesus
correct.
Returns, he returns to Missouri,
right.
not to Jerusalem.
Exactly. What's interesting, and this is the way I've heard people talk about this, is the message that people in other parts of the world take from that isn't simply that America is a special place. It is that God appears to everyone. God appeared not just in Palestine in the form of Jesus Christ, but God also appeared in the New World. So that, I mean, the lesson they take is not just America is special, but God is everywhere, and God can be here as well. So it's in a sense, you could say that is a sort of an international message that's being delivered, or at least the message of the church is sort of being spun that way.
My guest on today's Please Explain Look at the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is Laurie Maffley Kipp, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So what does it mean to be a full member of the LDS? And they prefer to be called LDS or Latter-day Saints than Mormons, don't they?
That's right. Yes, they don't want to be called Mormons. They prefer either the full title of the church, which is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or LDS.
But Jesus Christ has become a lot bigger now in the fronts of their buildings than it was in the past.
That's right. The logo has changed. This is one of the things that's happened in the last couple of decades, is that there has been an increased emphasis on the Jesus Christ part of their title.
Is that in response to people who felt uncomfortable about them as a Christian entity?
Well, that's an interesting question. It certainly coincided with the rise of conservative evangelicalism, and conservative evangelicals tend to be the most anti-Mormon of groups out there. So whether it's a response to that or sort of a preemptive way to say, you know, we are American and Christian as well, is hard to tell. I think the two go together.
Well, I asked earlier, can women become full members of the LDS?
Women can become full members, but women cannot be ordained to the priesthood. That is only for men. And all men over the age of 18 who are in good standing in the church potentially can become members of the priesthood.
Well, let's go back to the beginnings of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and Joseph Smith. When did he start having visions, and what were they?
In the early 1820s, Joseph Smith, and he wrote this down in as sort of his autobiography much later on, but he talked about how he and his family lived in this little town in upstate New York, and they were surrounded by all of these different churches and ministers, and this was a time when there were lots of religious revivals going on, and he didn't know what church to join. He was a Bible reader, and his family members were Bible readers, but they were unsure where to go because they were hearing, it was sort of like a marketplace. You know, they were hearing all of these different kinds of preaching from different people and join our church or join our church. And he didn't know what to do. So he went into the woods and prayed about it and asked God to tell him which church he ought to join. And he later described that God appeared to him and told him at that point not to join any church, told him to wait and just, you know, be faithful, and that eventually this would all become clear. His path would become clear, but not to join any church right now because they were all false. And over the course of the next 3, 4, 5 years, he had more visions, was visited by an angel named Moroni, told about these plates that were buried in a hillside that he would be called upon to translate. And finally, in 1827, he said that Moroni allowed him to take the golden plates and translate them into the Book of Mormon.
But then the golden plates were taken away from Joseph Smith. Why?
That's right. Then the golden plates were taken away. Well, he doesn't explain why they were taken away, only that, you know, they weren't. He was told that other people were not supposed to see them. But he was allowed, before the book was published, he was allowed to have 11 witnesses see the plates and testify to the fact that they had seen the plates. And now, if you open a copy of the Book of Mormon, one of the first things you will see is the testimony of one testimony with 3 witnesses and the other with 8 witnesses, all of whom claim that they themselves saw the golden plates.
How does the Book of Mormon relate? Was the Book of Mormon the translation of the Golden Plates?
Yes.
And how does it relate to the Old and New Testaments?
The Book of Mormon is claims to be a chronicle of some of the tribes of Israel who end up taking a boat to the Americas in the ancient world and flourishing on the American continent. And like the people, like the tribes of Israel in the old world, they are also visited by Christ after his resurrection. So there are a lot of passages in the Book of Mormon that are actually parallel to parts of the Book of Isaiah in the Hebrew Scriptures and parts of the Book of Matthew in the New Testament.
But different in some ways.
Different in some ways. But
which has upset any number of evangelicals.
Right, and they're not just upset by the fact that the translation's slightly different or the interpretation's slightly different. They're upset by the fact that Joseph Smith has even made these claims at all.
When did it take on the name The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints?
Oh, gosh.
Because a Mormon is the name that's usually applied.
Right,
so
right.
Were they called Mormons from the start?
They were called Mormons by outsiders from the start. The first name they took on was the Church of Christ, and the name changed, and I don't remember the exact chronology of exactly when it became the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, but it was sometime in the mid-1830s. So it was, you know, a number of years after the founding of the church.
Well, you said there were many competing churches at the time. Why did Joseph Smith's new religious movement become so popular so quickly?
That is an interesting question. Actually, it wasn't popular at the very beginning. The book, when he published the Book of Mormon right before he had founded the church, it didn't sell well at all, and it took a while to catch on. For a number of years, it was just a group sort of extended families, who, including the Smith family, who were loyal to Joseph Smith and who believed in his role as a prophet, but it wasn't until about the mid-1830s that by then the church had to move out to Ohio because more people hated them than liked them, and they had been drummed out of New York, moved out to Ohio, and then they started taking on converts, in part, I think, because they converted a number of very well-known preachers in the area who were popular preachers to begin with, and they then started to bring in a lot more converts to the church. So it took a while. I mean, it took a few years before things really caught on. And, it, you know, in the meantime, the church was moving from Ohio into Missouri and finally up to Nauvoo, Illinois by the late 1830s. So they were on the move all of this time as well.
And then eventually, after Joseph Smith was killed, they wound up going on to Utah. And we don't have to cover all of that because that's been pretty much described on a lot of television shows and a lot of histories.
Right.
But when did the Mormons begin to practice polygamy? Was that a part of their appeal, or was that also a problem for a lot of people?
I would not say it was part of their appeal, and it was a problem at times. They did not practice polygamy from the beginning. In fact, it's actually a pretty controversial question exactly when polygamy started. It's clear that Joseph Smith himself took on plural wives sometime in the early 1830s. It wasn't until much later on, though, that this was revealed, first to just a few of his followers who knew about it by the early 1840s. And eventually it was made public by Brigham Young in 1852. So it wasn't for quite a while before most everyone else. So there had been rumors, lots of rumors flying around, even while Joseph Smith was alive, about this practice of plural marriage. But it wasn't confirmed until after Brigham Young had moved the church out to Utah Territory. Remember, it was a territory at the time, not a state, and so they weren't subject to the same kinds of restrictions. At that point, Brigham Young announces that the church is practicing plural marriage, as they called it, and it creates a huge uproar that goes on for decades.
And he winds up being the person to renounce plural marriage as well.
Not Brigham Young.
It was in 1890. He was already no longer with us?
He was gone. He died in 1877. So, no, it was Wilford Woodruff who was president of the church in the 1890s when the doctrine was changed or renounced.
And that was as part of a deal to gain Utah statehood?
Or
to prevent the U.S. government? There was a lot of tension with the U.S. government at that point.
It had been going on, and that's right. And by the late 1880s, the government essentially confiscated all of the property of the church and was going to basically dissolve the church unless they stopped the practice of plural marriage. And of course, once the idea of their temples and their meeting houses being gone, once that was on the line, it certainly created pressure to do something, to change something. Now, Woodruff presents it in a press release, he doesn't call it a revelation, it's a press release, but it's considered to be the result of prayer and revelation from God that the time has come to stop this practice.
My guest is Laurie Maffley Kipp, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at University of North Carolina, co-author of a book soon to be published called Proclamation to the People, 19th Century Mormonism and the Pacific Basin Frontier. We will continue our conversation on today's Please Explain and take your calls. Our number is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. After this. We're back with Laurie Maffley Kipp, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina. We're talking about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints on today's Please Explain. How did they wind up with the name Mormons?
Well, they didn't, in the sense that they never were officially called the Mormons, but they were called Mormons because the book that Joseph Smith published was called the Book of Mormon, and it was called the Book of Mormon because it was represented to be the work of an ancient scribe in the Americas named Mormon, who had compiled all of these records, and then he had passed them on to his son Moroni, and Moroni had buried them in this hillside, and those were the golden plates that Joseph Smith claimed to have found in 1827. So Mormon was simply the name of one of these New World prophets, and because his name was attached to the book, when people saw the publication of the book, they took that as the name, or they called the Mormons in the early days.
When did LDS start to grow into a major religion?
That's an interesting question. Up until about in the early 1960s, it was still pretty much a church where the majority of followers were in the Intermountain West, mostly in Utah, into California, Arizona, surrounding areas. And it wasn't until really the mid to late 60s that the international growth of the church really took off. Now, there's always been an active missionary impulse, even from the very earliest times. Joseph Smith, after he founded the church, he almost immediately sent missionaries off, first to the East Coast and to England, to start evangelizing. And so in the 19th century, there were lots of European migrants from Scandinavia, from Great Britain, who came over and went straight out to Utah with the Mormons there. But it wasn't really until after the 1960s that the church grew internationally.
And we see all of these young Mormons going off for two-year missions, but I'm not sure whether they're expected to proselytize to the point of achieving a lot of conversions, or whether something else is expected of that experience.
I think most missionaries would tell you that they are not judged, and they don't judge themselves on how many people they baptize. That's important, and it's important for them to spread the word to other people. But most missionaries that I have talked to talk about it as really a time for personal growth and development, and that it's a way for them to sort of test themselves, to grow spiritually, and so it's less, you know, it's less about how many people you baptize and more about developing yourself.
And they're discouraged from having too much contact with the folks back home. I guess that's part of this growth. A listener writes in to our comment page, "When I was in college, I was approached by two Mormon guys who asked me, 'Do you know Jesus Christ?' So that's the sort of question that we would expect from other kinds of Christian groups. Do Mormons think of Jesus in the same way as other Christians?"
I wouldn't say they think of Jesus in the same way. They believe that, unlike most evangelicals, they believe that Jesus has a body, a real flesh and blood body, as does God. So, and most evangelicals would completely deny that.
They said that God was not a spirit or something. God was a real man.
Yes, yes. And this is one of the things that other people got so upset about, is that sort of the idea that there's a material, God is a material being, and Jesus is a material being. And so I wouldn't say that when they say Jesus Christ, they really mean exactly the same thing by it, although the Mormons would say that they follow the same teachings. They read the Bible. They, you know, pray to Jesus Christ. And so that's where the rub is, really, with the evangelicals, is how do you define this person you're talking about?
Now, just one more thing before we start taking calls. The church has been linked with conservative Republican politics over the years. In fact, Ezra Taft Benson is my first memory of somebody who actually was a top Mormon who wound up in a Republican administration, wasn't he? Eisenhower's cabinet. But how did that happen? I would have thought that a group that had felt so outside for so long would definitely have associated itself with a different kind of politics.
Mormons have always had an ambivalent relationship to the American political scene. On the one hand, they do share a lot of the values that other conservative Americans might share: patriotism, sort of devotion to certain kinds of values, family values, obviously. On the other hand, because of their history of persecution, they also tend to be pretty wary about crossing the church-state divide, and they tend to focus more than a lot of evangelicals do on reserving sort of individual choice for human beings. The one word that Mormons use a lot is human agency, individual agency. Yes, we're part of a larger church, but we also each for ourselves have to exercise our own agency.
Let's take some calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. My guest is Lori Mafley Kipp, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina. And before we get to the calls, Lori, a number of people want to know if you are a member of the church.
I am not, no.
Okay. But you have become an expert, obviously. We go now to Richard from Manhattan. Please turn off your radio because it will be a bit confusing. We're on a slight delay.
I just did it.
Okay, Richard.
I have two questions. You said that the evangelicals are the most antipathetic to the Mormons. The first question is, how do the Mormons relate to and reconcile with other religious groups such as Jews, Catholics, and figures in those religions, Moses, and figures in Catholicism? And secondly, I heard that the projection is that in the primaries, Mitt Romney would win the Massachusetts primary, and of course he had been governor of Massachusetts. And I don't usually think of Massachusetts as a Mormon stronghold. Has Mormonism seems not to be an issue in that particular state?
A state with a very strong Catholic population, for example.
Right. I'm not a political expert, but I would assume that his popularity in Massachusetts has to do more with his time as governor there, that people got to know him. Now, I don't know much more than that to tell you. But in regard to your first question about relationships with other religious groups, Mormons have always argued that they are the true Christians. Their church is the true church of Christ. So that when Joseph Smith translated the golden plates and prophecy was restored to the earth, they were restoring true Christianity that had been lost. And the implication in that is that Catholics and Protestants had it all wrong. They had been corrupted over the years. They had gone astray. And so this is what Protestants were so upset about in the first place, and presumably Catholics too, is that the implication was that Mormons were saying that you guys aren't really Christians. On the other hand, on a practical level, Mormons outside of Utah, I think, have tended to be fairly, ecumenical about working with other people. Utah is a sort of a special case because in Utah, for so long, the church has controlled so much of what goes on in Salt Lake City and the surrounding areas that there's a lot of resentment that's built up. And so I think it's harder to make connections with other religious groups in that area when the church controls a lot of property. There are a lot of other issues, that get tied into it.
People are asking about links to Freemasonry because of all the secrecy, because of the special garments in the temple.
Right. Joseph Smith was interested in Freemasonry. He didn't like Freemasonry in and of itself, but it's pretty clear that a lot of the early rituals of the church were drawn from a time when he got very interested in Masonry. Now, what I've heard Mormons say is that just because there's an association between Masonry and early Mormonism doesn't necessarily mean it isn't ordained by God, because in fact Mormons, if you believe that Mormons are restoring true Christianity and the ancient rites of the church, one of those areas of ancient rites are these Masonic traditions. So they feel that this is in fact a restoration of esoteric rituals that ancient peoples already used.
When did the fundamentalist church of Latter-day Saints split off from the mainstream church? Was it only over the issue of polygamy?
It was after the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints renounced the practice of polygamy in the early, it really wasn't until the early 1907-8 that the church sort of definitively stopped practicing plural marriage and excommunicated people who did practice it. And over the next few decades, by the 1920s and 1930s, groups of fundamentalists who believed that plural marriage never should have been stopped broke off and formed their own communities.
Do they resemble the LDS the way it was in the late 19th or early 20th century?
In some ways, if you, you know, watch Big Love, maybe you know something about this.
I'm sure they didn't live in trailers in those days.
Right. Well, the kind of dress, that the old sort of old-fashioned dress that women wear, long hair, there are things that sort of look reminiscent of homesteaders in the late 19th century. On the other hand, there are, you know, lots of ways in which they live very much in the 21st century now. So,
Pat, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I was at an interfaith meeting last week, and there were two of the young men, elder missionaries, and I was telling them how friends of mine will not vote because they feel that they couldn't vote for where they have this temple with this secret. Could you tell me what's in the temple? They try to explain you can only go into it if you are pure, and there are sacred things there, but I didn't know enough to ask what were they.
Yeah, right. You can go into most other houses of worship. Why not to LDS churches?
Right. LDS consider their temples not just secret, but sacred places. And they also have meeting houses where wards meet, and you can go into those. You can go any Sunday. You can go to services there. But the idea of the temple is that only someone who is worthy, what they call temple worthy, can go into the temple. And to be temple worthy, you need to uphold certain of the virtues that the church teaches, like the word of wisdom, not drinking alcohol, not smoking, being chaste, and you meet on a regular basis with your bishop to make sure that you are still temple worthy. And what goes on in there? There are various kinds of rituals that go on. That's where.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry, we've run out of time.